We sort of got an introduction to it the last time I spoke, which has been so long I can't even remember when it was. So in chapters 9 and 10 of 2 Samuel, we saw David at his finest. But sadly, when we come to chapter 11, which is David's great sin, we see him at his worst. And you know, there's a verse that gives really a commentary, on the whole incident. And it's not a commentary by a human Bible scholar. It's God's commentary himself concerning David. And certainly, David was a great man. He was a man after God's heart. He was, in so many ways, a lovely type of the Lord Jesus Christ. And he wrote so many of the Psalms. And most Christians have greatly benefited from David's writings. His pen has touched millions upon millions of hearts. And yet, that being said, he wasn't infallible, and he wasn't sinless. And what we're going to see tonight is his great sin with Bathsheba. But the commentary that I want to read to you is God's commentary, his comment on David's life. And this is what we read. It's in 1 Kings chapter 15 and verse 5. 1 Kings 15:5, because David did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord and turned not aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, save only in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Now that's quite a statement. This is God's comment. He did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord. Turn not aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And that's exactly what we're going to be seeing tonight. And it's such a reminder, too, that the Bible is very real. It doesn't gloss over things. It's reality. And even as we think about some of the greatest characters in the Old Testament, for example, we see that God is careful not to conceal their faults, their shortcomings, their sins. I mean, you take Abraham, the father of all that believe, the one man that God used to build the nation of Israel. And yet we see Abraham practicing deceit, telling his wife to lie about who she was, and even in a man like Abraham, we see flaws. We think about Moses and how he lost his temper and how that it cost him the very thing he longed for, which was to lead the people into the promised land. Moses had his faults. Jacob, again, the father of the 12 sons that became the 12 tribes of Israel, he was a deceiver, and he lied, and he practiced treachery. And so even amongst the finest of the saints, the Bible records their flaws, and we're going to see that tonight with David. So chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, verse 1. And it came to pass, after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. So it was a time when he woulda, coulda, shoulda been on the battlefield, when kings went forth to battle. And that was what kings did in David's day. He would lead the people. He would lead the nation in battles. But he stayed behind. And you sort of get the tone of that with the way the narrator states it. It was in a time when kings go forth to battle that David, he delegated that responsibility to Joab, his commander-in-chief, also his nephew. But David tarried at Jerusalem. He should have been leading his people, but he wasn't. And it proved to be a very fateful result of him staying behind rather than leading the people in battle. It came to pass, verse 2, in an eventide, that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. And David sent and inquired after the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers and took her. And she came in unto him, and he lay with her. For she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her house. And the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, "I'm with child, I'm pregnant." So here was David when he should have been on the battlefield. Instead, he tarried. And he's perhaps after an afternoon siesta. I think that was the habit in those days. He took a stroll on his rooftop and he looked and he saw a beautiful woman taking a bath. And he not only saw her, but he began to lust after her. And he said, I've got to have her. She's beautiful to look at. And he saw and he sent and he took her. He allowed lust to overcome him. And unlike Job, where we read in chapter 31, where Job writes this, chapter 31 and verse 1, "I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid?" He made a covenant. He made a promise. He made a vow, as it were, that he would guard his eyes. And we need to guard our eyes and we need to guard our hearts. But David looked, and then he continued to look, and he liked what he saw, and he lusted after her. And he sent after her to find out who she was. Turned out she was a married woman. She was the wife of Uriah. You have to wonder what that servant must have thought when he was commanded to go and find out who that beautiful woman is bathing on the rooftop. It's like, it doesn't really matter who she is. She doesn't belong to you. I mean, you've already got, aren't seven wives enough? Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 17 warns kings against multiplying wives. And this is exactly what ended up as a result of all of this. He added another wife to the list. And so David, it started with a look. He saw, he sent, and he took her. You know, it's a pattern we see. We see it in the garden with Adam and Eve. Eve saw that forbidden fruit. She lusted after it. She desired it. You know, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life. You take of that fruit and you'll be like God. You'll know good and evil and so forth. And that's the pattern we see. We lust after, and then we take. And that's exactly the tools that Satan used to bring about the fall of man. And we see it not only there, but we see it in Joshua chapter 7. And this is a pretty famous passage with Achan. It says there in verse 21, "When I saw among the spoils a goodly Babylonish garment and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, then I coveted them and took them. Behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent and the silver under it." He saw, he coveted, he took. That was Achan. Same thing with Eve. She saw, she coveted, she lusted, and she took of that forbidden fruit. David saw. He should have as Paul exhorts us to flee youthful lust, to make no provision for the flesh. Sometimes things like this might happen and it might be unavoidable, but the sin becomes dwelling upon it. We should, like Joseph, we should run from it. We should flee youthful lusts. And of course, as we know, it ended up causing quite a problem in David's life, the fact that he didn't resist, he didn't use self-control. And it's the same pattern that we see in James. James talks about it. Every man, this is chapter 1, verse 14, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. That's the process. It was true then. It was true in Achan's day. It was true in Eve's day. And it's true today. So we need to guard against this. He saw, he sent, he took her, he lay with her. And the next thing you know, she's pregnant. Now, beginning at verse 6, what we have in the rest of the chapter is the big cover-up. We have the big cover-up. And again, some things just never change. Isn't that what Adam and Eve did? After they took of that forbidden fruit, what did they do? They tried to hide from God. It didn't work. And David, it's so ironic. David's the one that penned Psalm 139. And of course, that psalm is well known for describing how that there's nowhere we can go that God isn't present. There's nowhere to hide. God, all things are naked and open before him with whom we have to do. There are no secret sins with God. We might keep it a secret from one another, but there are no secret sins as far as God. And David knew that. David wrote Psalm 139. And yet, we see the rest of the chapter. We see what resulted from that sin with Bathsheba. He gets word that she's pregnant. Now we got a big problem. By the way, adultery was, of course, one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. David knew that. He had broken one of the Ten Commandments, and it was punishable by death. David had a real problem on his hands. So how did he handle it? How did he address it? Well, he started out with a big cover-up. He said, I got to hide this thing. I got to make this look like it's her husband's child, not my child. And so the rest of the chapter describes that situation. So let's begin where we left off at verse 6. And David sent to Joab, saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. Now, Uriah was one of David's mighty men. So was Joab. Joab was his nephew, and he was the commander-in-chief. He was the one that successfully brought down the Jebusites and was able to have David take over the city of Zion. So anyway, he sends for Uriah, one of his mighty men. And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah was come unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did and how the people did and how the war prospered. In other words, he's making it look like he just wants to hear a firsthand report of what's going on the battlefield. You look at that and you have to wonder, wouldn't he normally have just asked Joab about that? Well, it would seem to me that would make more sense. But nevertheless, he asked Uriah. It's like, okay, I've got a reason for calling you into my presence. I want to get a firsthand report of how things are going. How are things on the battlefront? Okay. And David said to Uriah, go down to your house, verse 8, and wash your feet. In other words, Have a little bit of R&R, a little bit of relaxation. Go home and be with your wife. Perhaps enjoy some intimacy with your wife and take a little break. You've been on the battlefield. Take a break. Have a little R&R. And Uriah departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. So what was that about? Well, David, of course, he's desperate. I mean, he is in a real bind. He's gotten this woman pregnant. And before long, she's going to start showing. And then he's going to have a real problem on his hands. So I got to get her husband home, so that maybe it'll look like the child belongs to the two of them, not my child. And so he's in a bit of a panic. You can imagine how he feels. It's like, you know, I got to take care of this problem. This can be a real problem down the road. And so he calls him and he says, he gets a report from the battlefield. He says, why don't you go home and have a little time with your wife or whatever. And he sent some meat along. That was a little insurance policy to be sure that he went home. It's like, I got all this food. What am I going to do with it? The only logical thing to do with it is to go home with it. He thought that might be the extra little insurance to be sure that Uriah went home and was with his wife. But didn't work. Didn't work. And Uriah, verse 7, departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and went not down to his house. It didn't work. David's plan didn't work. And when they had told David, saying, Uriah went not down unto his house, David said unto Uriah, camest thou not away, not from thy journey? Why then didst thou not go down unto thine house? Why didn't you go home? Why didn't you go home? David is getting frustrated. David is getting a little panicky. It's like, you know, Bathsheba's going to start showing, and I'm going to have some explaining to do here. Why didn't you go home? He's really getting frustrated because his efforts to get Uriah home are not working. And Uriah said to David, Uriah was a noble, faithful servant of David. Uriah was one of the mighty men of David, willing to die for David's honor. And instead, as we see, he's going to die for David's sin, not his honor, for his sin. Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go into my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing. Uriah is saying, listen, all of my men, along with Joab, the commander-in-chief, they're living in tents. They're sleeping out in the fields. I wouldn't feel right going home, sleeping in a nice soft bed with my wife. That's not the example I want to set. I want to be there with my men. You've got to admire Uriah for that attitude. So he's explaining this to David, and you've got to imagine David is like, man, this is not going as intended. Everything I do to try to get Uriah to his own house, it's nothing is working. Nothing is working. So he does one last thing. David said to Uriah, verse 12, tarry here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart. So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him, and he made him drunk. He thought, now, this will work. I'll get him drunk. He won't be thinking straight, and maybe then he'll go home, and problem solved, right? And he made him drunk. And at even he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but went not down to his house. So everything David has tried has not worked. And the pressure is building and the anxiety, and you can only imagine, you know, the sleepless nights and the guilt and the shame and just imagining what's going to happen if I don't get this problem fixed. I'm going to be guilty of adultery, a sin punishable by death. What in the world am I going to do? He's feeling the pressure. So here's how he handles it. And it came to pass in the morning, verse 14, that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter saying, set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retire ye from him that he may be smitten and die. And it came to pass when Joab observed the city that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew that valiant men were. And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab. And there fell some of the people of the servants of David. And Uriah the Hittite died also. Now, I want you to think about the emotions and just try to imagine what this must have been like for David. To basically, to write a man's death sentence and hand it to him. A letter saying to Joab, I want you to put Uriah in the heat of the battle, and then I want you to retreat so that he'll be killed. David, what are you thinking? And listen, not only did Uriah get killed, but a number of other soldiers died as well. That, you know what that means? That means mothers lost their sons, and wives lost their husbands, and kids lost their fathers. This is serious business. There were other casualties, all because of David's sin. I mean, this is serious. How in the world could David come up with such a plan? He's in a panic. He's a desperate man. He's sitting there thinking, you know, any day somebody's going to notice Bathsheba's pregnant, and what am I going to do? And I got a real problem on my hands. I got to get rid of Uriah. So he comes up with this scheme to have him killed. He was directly responsible for the death of one of his mighty men, Uriah. And he gave the death sentence to Uriah, saying, here, take this to Joab. How could you do that? How could you look that man in the eyes and say, here, give this to Joab? This is your death warrant. But he did it. And it all started with a look. It all started with the gaze. Oh, how does it go? Oh, what a web we weave when first we endeavor to deceive. And that's what happened. The next thing you know, he's killed an innocent man. He's made Bathsheba a widow. He's been responsible for the death of other soldiers. It is hard to imagine, but that's exactly what happened. Innocent men died. So verse 18. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war. So Uriah is killed. Joab sent a messenger to tell David how things were going. And he charged the messenger, saying, when thou hast made an end of telling the matters of the war unto the king, and if so be that the king's wrath arise, and he say unto thee, wherefore approachest ye so nigh unto the city when ye did fight? Know ye not that they would shoot from the wall? Who smote Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaasheth? Did not a woman cast a piece of a millstone upon him from the wall, that he died in Thebes? Why went ye nigh the wall? Then say thou, now Joab speaking to his messenger, anticipating how this conversation is going to go. When David says this to you, then I want you to say, thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So, Joab sends the messenger to give the report to David. And he knows that David is going to question their tactics in coming so close to this wall and could possibly bring up this situation that had previously happened where if you get too close to the wall, you're at a disadvantage and they can shoot down on you. In fact, it even gives this example of the lady that used the millstone to kill someone. He says, when David finds objection with your tactics, be sure to tell him that Uriah is dead also, because that's going to change his tune. That's going to make him happy. In other words, mission accomplished. And that's exactly what happened. Let's read about it. Verse 22. So the messenger went and came and showed David all that Joab had sent him for. And the messenger said unto David, surely the men prevailed against us and came out unto us into the field, and we were upon them even unto the entering of the gate. And the shooters shot from off the wall upon thy servants, and some of the king's servants be dead, and thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Just as Joab had planned, okay? This is what happened. We lost some men, but Uriah the Hittite died in the process. Now, verse 25 is unbelievable. Then David said unto the messenger, thus shalt thou say unto Joab, let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make the battle more strong against the city and overthrow it, and encourage thou him. It's like, you got to be kidding me, David. You wrote this man's death sentence. You're the one who made this plan to have Uriah killed. And now you're going to pretend like you're going to offer words of comfort to Joab, the commander of the army, by saying, Joab, don't take it personal. This is just, you know, this is just how it is. This is just the casualties of war. Things, you know, que sera, sera. What will be, will be. People get killed. You know, don't feel bad. This is just sort of how it is. David, you are personally responsible for the death of Uriah. And how can you say such a thing? How can those words come out of your mouth? The sword devours one as well as another. Like, you know, I'm some wise old sage giving all this wisdom here. Wait a minute. No, you killed the man. You are personally responsible for his death. And you're trying to act like you're trying to console Joab. And let me tell you, by the way, obviously, Joab was a part of this plan. Let me tell you something. Sin can be forgiven, but sin has consequences. Sin has consequences. And David might think, well, you know, it didn't work. I couldn't get Uriah to go home to his wife, to have relations with his wife, so I'll just get him killed. Well, problem is not solved, because now, number one, he's got his own guilt to deal with. He's got his own conscience to live with. And Joab is wise to what's going on. He gave that letter to Uriah, who gave it to Joab, which instructed Joab to basically see to it that Uriah got killed in battle. So now Joab, his commander-in-chief, also his nephew, knows what's going on, knows there's something wrong going on here. Now David, as if he didn't have enough to be, you know, worried about, he's got to wonder now what might happen if Joab spills the beans. Think this through a minute. You know, Joab now knows what's going on. Joab knows that I had Uriah killed. And what if Joab spills the beans? Now I got to lay in bed at night and worry about that. Let me tell you what. There are consequences to sin. Cover-ups don't work. They just don't work. We can try them all we want to, but they just don't work. You just create, you know, oh, what a web we weave. He's weaving a bigger web. Now he's got Joab to worry about. And what about all the soldiers that were killed as a result of this plan to get Uriah killed? He's got that on his conscience as well. And Joab knows something's going on. And you don't have to be too smart to figure out, even if it's after the fact, here's Bathsheba with child. She's pregnant. David had, you know, her husband. You don't have to be too smart to figure out that David's the father of this child. Okay? Anyway, it's a major problem. Verse 26, and when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when the morning was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife and bare him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. He might have put a Band-Aid on the problem, but God was not pleased. God knew exactly what was going on. He knows exactly what goes on in David's life. He knows exactly what goes on in our life. So, what can we learn from this? What can we learn from this? Well, to me, one of the most striking lessons of this chapter is this. And I'll tell you something. Y'all listen up. If you forget everything else I've said, I want you to really pay attention to this, because this is huge in my view anyway. And it's simply this. Our decisions that we make all the time, day in and day out, we may not know at the time what gigantic consequences our decisions are going to have. We may not realize what's going to happen as a result of these decisions that we make. So we need to be careful. We need to be careful. I mean, I think it's safe to say David had absolutely no idea that day he took a stroll on his rooftop, and that which ensued from that, he had an afternoon invested, part of an afternoon invested, that would change his life forever and leave a mar on his reputation. And it would be recorded in the Word of God for all eternity. David had no idea that as a result of, rather than look the other way and flee youthful lust, he let that lust burn, that desire burn. Like Samson, you know. Judges, I think it's 16 maybe. He saw that woman, that Philistine woman. He saw her. He lusted after her. He says, I've got to have her. She pleases me well. He should have run the other way. David should have run the other way. And he made a decision. He made a decision in a few moments that ended up causing him, and we're going to see as his story unfolds, all kinds of grief, the guilt and the shame and the worry and the lies that he had to tell and the lives that were cost as a result. All of this because of one decision. He had no idea the ultimate repercussions of that one decision. No idea. He would end up being a liar, an adulterer, a murderer, a deceiver, I mean, and have to live. And all you got to do, if you don't think it troubled his soul, you just need to read Psalm 51 and Psalm 32. He talks about this sin was a plague to him, and it will be a plague to us as well. This is serious business. We don't realize the far-reaching consequences of our decisions. Now, it can go both ways. It can go both ways. Do you think that day long ago at the borders of Moab when Ruth made the decision to, rather than like her sister-in-law, rather than turn back to Moab like her sister-in-law did, she made that decision in chapter 1, I think it's verse 18, that she was going to go forward with Naomi. And that Naomi's God was going to be her God. Naomi's people were going to be her people. And where Naomi was buried, she was going to be buried. She declared her loyalty to the one true God, Jehovah. Do you think she had even an inkling of the far-reaching consequences of the decision she made that day? Ruth, I'd like to whisper in your ear. Guess what? That decision you made to go back to Bethlehem, Judah with Naomi, do you know what's going to happen as a result? You're going to be one of only four women in the entire Word of God mentioned by name in the genealogy of the Savior. you're going to become David's great-grandmother. And you're a Moabitess. Can you imagine that? I don't think she had any idea. I don't think she had any idea whatsoever. All of the blessings that were going to be hers because of that decision. She didn't know, and neither did David. My point is, there can be incredibly fantastic repercussions to our decisions, and there can be incredibly horrible repercussions to our decisions. I'm going to finish on time, which is a rarity, so I got time for one story. I'm going to tell you one quick story. Because I was thinking about this. There's this whole notion, and it's huge, that just we go through life and we make all these decisions all the time, and we just don't know. Every decision we make as a believer is so important. When I first came under conviction of sin as a senior in college, I put every decision, and I wasn't even saved, and I figured out that, look, I got to get to the root of this whole issue about my sin and whether Christianity is real for me. I got to get this matter settled because it's going to have a huge impact on every decision I make. I put every major decision in my life on hold until I got to the bottom of this Christianity business because I knew it would make a big impact. And it does. The decision, we might think they're little decisions. There are no little decisions. The Christian life is basically, it's all about choices that we make. So the story I was going to tell you is I was thinking about how, you know, we a lot of times make decisions and we just don't know, you know, how bad they're going to turn out or how good they're going to turn out. So this story came to my mind. my son-in-law, his college roommate, one of his best friends, they were college roommates and best friends, and they served in Afghanistan together. They fought together. Came back, and he lived in his house with them. And they were like inseparable, like best friends. And anyway, so they both went to Ranger School. In fact, the other guy was on TV. He did it as a fluke. He entered the toughest Ranger contest, and he finished really high. I mean, this guy's a real deal. They both became Green Berets, but the other guy, his roommate. I'm not even going to try to get into it other than to say there's a somewhat secretive group within Special Forces that are strategically located around the world, and therefore, like crisis situations, their rapid deployment, they are literally the most highly trained soldiers on the planet, and his roommate is one of those guys. Okay, and anyway, so a few years ago, his roommate was down in Charleston. It was in the summer, and these guys train like you wouldn't believe. And so they're always eating. They have to eat a lot just to maintain the caloric intake. So it was late one night, and his name is Nate. He went downtown to one of these late night pizza places, and he ordered a couple of pieces of pizza by the slice, and he went out on the sidewalk, and they had tables set up. So he's sitting there minding his own business in downtown Charleston eating his pizza. He had just bought a new iPhone. It was like $600. That was back when iPhones were, you could get one for $600. I don't think that's true anymore. So he's sitting there at his table minding his own business with his brand new iPhone sitting there. And this guy came along with the express intent of stealing his iPhone. And he gets engaged in a conversation. So Nate's just eating his pizza, minding his own business. And anyway, the guy grabbed his phone. And he was a pretty big guy. He was a pretty big fella. And he wasn't used to anybody ever resisting him. But this is not the guy whose phone you want to take. And anyway, so the point of my story is the consequences of our decisions. So I've often thought how I would love to have been there to whisper in this guy's ear and say, by the way, pal, let me tell you a little bit about this guy whose phone you're getting ready to steal. They meet the president on regular basis. They're like, I don't know if you'd say first name basis, but they're the most elite soldiers on this planet, okay? And he knows how to hurt you. He's a professional at that. And you might want to rethink what you're about to do. Because as a matter of fact, in about 3 minutes, you're going to be missing most of your front teeth, and you're not going to be able to see because your eyes are going to be swollen shut. And you're going to be pleading with him to take your phone back. Because that's what happened. The guy took his phone, and Nate grabbed him by the dreadlocks and pulverized him. And the guy said, please take your phone back. So what's the point of that story? I shouldn't enjoy a story like that, but every now and then, justice, right? The point is this. That guy had no idea what was about to happen as a result of the decision he had made to steal the guy's phone. He had no idea. And he learned a tough lesson, okay? What does that mean to you and to me? We need to take decisions seriously because they have consequences. And David's decision had big consequences. You go home and you read Psalm 32 and Psalm 51, and you'll feel the agony of soul that came, all started with just a look. It all traces back to that one look. He should have been on the battlefield. He was where he shouldn't have been, maybe doing something he shouldn't have, I don't know. But he looked, he saw, he should have turned the other way. And that principle is true today. You know, what's the saying? I'll pick on Jake here. As a golfer, what's the saying? 90% of all putts that are short don't go in. Did you hear that? Words of wisdom here. 90% of all putts that are short don't go in. Well, let me give you a more useful statistic than that. 100% of people that never take the first drink never become alcoholics. 100% of all those that never try drugs never become drug addicts. 100% of people that never start to look at pornography become hooked on it. 100%. We need to guard our eyes, and we need to guard our hearts, we need to guard our minds, because it might seem like a little thing, and yet we may find that it can wreck our lives, and we're going to see big consequences to this sin in David's life. So we'll stop with that.